This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Carrie Schenkman about a recent decision from the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. The working group found that Julian Assange has indeed been subjected to arbitrary detention. The group called on Britain and Sweden to end his deprivation of liberty. We remember the consummate people's attorney, Myron Beldock. The New York Times wrote of Myron that he had an important hand in cases that helped define the landscape of 20th century law. We'll talk with Sienna Baskin from the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center here in New York.
Should sex work be decriminalized? We all think so.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Validating what WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's legal team has long been asserting, the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention recently found that Assange has indeed been subjected to arbitrary detention. The working group has called on Britain and Sweden to end his deprivation of liberty. As listeners will recall, Julian was arrested in 2010 and has been staying at the Ecuadorian embassy in London since 2012, when he sought asylum. He's wanted for questioning over an allegation of rape made in 2010, which he denies. Great Britain and Sweden rejected the UN panel's findings. Prime Minister David Cameron has said that Assange should leave the embassy and submit himself to a Swedish arrest warrant over allegations of rape to bring an end to what he called this whole sorry saga. Cameron dismissed as ridiculous the findings of the panel and said that Assange had in fact detained himself. Joining us to talk about this recent and significant development is First Amendment attorney Carrie Schenkman, who, along with our own Michael Ratner, is a member of the Assange defense team. Carrie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be on the show, Heidi.
Carrie, you've waited 15 months for this independent review. What is the significance?
Well, this is a very, very significant victory because all along he's wanted a process and deserved a process that takes into account independently, takes into account all of the evidence. And this has been that process that has actually taken into account the fact that he has asylum. In 2012, Mr. Assange was granted asylum by Ecuador because of a risk of persecution and inhuman treatment that he faces in the United States for his publishing activities. And to date, both the UK and Sweden have refused to recognize his asylum or offer any consideration to the risk of persecution he faces.
What does the finding that Julian was arbitrarily detained have in terms of next steps for the legal team?
Well, this decision by the UN's highest authority on detention, and this is a very important body in finding. This decision is binding on the UK and Sweden. The UN Human Rights Council came forward and reiterated that. It's based on binding international human rights treaties, and it's also a process that both states signed up for. So during this 16-month review, both states had an opportunity to submit their evidence and arguments, and both states did. So they signed up to this process, and the UK and Sweden now can't just say that they're not going to play because they don't like the way it came out. In terms of the next steps, we're looking to both states to implement the decision. There certainly is disappointment by some of the statements that have come out of the UK and Sweden. So the UK foreign minister said that decision was ridiculous. And in counter to that, actually, the General Counsel of Human Rights Watch shot back at both governments, saying that it was deplorable that the UK and Sweden would ignore the outcome of a process that they participated in. Keep in mind that this the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention is instrumental and the release of hundreds of prisoners detained worldwide just last year. I mean, directly credited with the release of hundreds. So by trying to undermine this institution over just one case, these countries are really doing harm to a fundamental system of international human rights. And I personally worry about the effects that their statements will have on other governments respecting the decisions of this body when it comes to people in the future who are being arbitrarily detained.
So on a practical level, you say this is binding, and we know that Great Britain and Sweden have called this a ridiculous finding. What does it mean for Julian? What would happen if he walked out of the embassy right now?
Well, the UK has repeated that it'll arrest Julian and extradite him to Sweden, where he faces allegations. He's not been charged with any crime in Sweden. Allegations, and after 5 years, still only allegations. So the UK is insisting on extraditing him to Sweden. And the Swedes so far have not advanced the case forward. That was actually instrumental in the UN opinion, because when they make a finding of arbitrary detention, there's really two steps. First is the person being detained. Second, is there a justification? Is there a reason for that? So on the first step, is he detained? The question is really, what are his options? Well, his only two options are to stay in the embassy or risk extradition to the United States to expose himself to a risk of persecution. So international law is very clear. If somebody is stuck between a rock and a hard place, where their only options are to be stuck inside or face a risk of persecution or a violation of their rights, then that situation is detention. So that's why the group decided that Julian's being detained. And second, there's no longer a valid reason for that detention. The group said that detaining someone for 5 years without being charged with a crime is, quote, ipso facto incompatible with the presumption of innocence. Again, he has not been charged with a crime in Sweden, and in any civilized legal system, every person is entitled to a presumption of innocence, but that's been completely wiped away because he's been subjected to this constant detention, this constant uncertainty about the future, now urgent medical problems and inability to see his family. And it's been completely disproportional to the Swedish failure to move forward the case. So in terms of really the next steps, I think this decision is very significant. It is based on binding obligations that, like I said, we look to both states to implement. But the next steps after that are really exploring what legal options are available.
Carrie, I want to just briefly take up the issue of Swedish prosecutors' failure to make use of so-called mutual assistance protocols by which Julian could be interviewed via video conference or something like that. With the passage of time and their failure to make any effort to interview him, does that also strengthen the case that they've acted without, you know, due process?
That fact, exactly, Heidi, was instrumental in the working group's opinion. And there's quite a lot of criticism of the Swedish prosecutor's failure to move the case forward. And this is not anything that's new. I mean, years ago, the legal community in Sweden was criticizing the prosecutor for the handling of this case. I mean, this is a case that has an extremely convoluted and prejudicial history from day one. From the very beginning in 2010, the case was actually initially cleared. So he was cleared of allegations, and then the case was taken up by a different prosecutor. His identity was leaked to the press, so, you know, his own privacy rights, because keep in mind, this is a very prejudicial allegation. He hasn't even been charged. It's extremely prejudicial to even allege such offenses. And then following that, you've had constant criticism by the Swedish legal classes. You've also seen criticism now by the UN, criticism by the Swedish courts. The Swedish Court of Appeals criticized the prosecutor. The Supreme Court looked to the prosecutor and were doing. So really, I mean, I think that's really the problem, is that so much time is going on. There's been an option to interview him at the embassy, and that has not been taken. And he's been asking for that for 5 years now, over 5 years.
Carrie, we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about the issue of Julian's health. I understand he has a shoulder pain. Is he allowed to have physicians come in and examine him?
Well, certainly physicians have come by the embassy to examine him, but the issue is that he now needs diagnosis and further treatment for severe shoulder pain. And a physician can come in and look at the shoulder, but what happens when you have a complicated joint and muscle issue? You have to go and get tests. But the problem is that the resources to test aren't available in the embassy. It's an embassy. It's not a hospital. So he can't get an MRI test, which doctors say he needs, because the MRI machine physically won't fit in the door. So it's really an issue that as long as he is in the embassy, as long as he is enjoying his asylum, he can't go to the hospital. And that's really an unacceptable choice, because he's been granted asylum. There's no dispute that he has asylum. Ecuador has recognized the risk of persecution he faces in the United States, where there's an ongoing attempt to prosecute him, and that's been ongoing for over 5 years. The basis for that persecution, it's not Ecuador alone that recognizes it. I mean, this investigation of WikiLeaks and Mr. Assange is widely condemned by free speech and press and human rights organizations around the world because of the terrible, outrageous precedent it would set for publishing and freedom of the press, basically setting a precedent that individuals who expose misconduct, war crimes, and abuses are subject to prosecution for that. And that's not acceptable in a democratic society. So, I mean, there's no question about the risk of persecution that Mr. Assange faces. The only issue is whether or not UK and Sweden are recognizing that, and why they continue to insist not to. So he can't be expected or forced to choose between maintaining his right to asylum and going to a hospital to get treatment.
Well said, Carrie, and we want to thank you for your work on this case and for joining us, as always, to keep us and our audience up to date on it.
Thank you for having me, Heidi.
It is with great sadness that we report that Myron Beldock, founding partner of the law firm Beldock, Levine & Hoffman, people's lawyer and longtime National Lawyers Guild member, passed away peacefully on February 1st. He was 86 years old. Jim Dwyer of the New York Times wrote that Myron had an important hand in cases that helped define the landscape of 20th century law, and in others that merely righted the grievous wrongs done to unknown people. Members of the National Lawyers Guild knew Myron not only as a brilliant attorney who took on the seemingly intractable cases of the wrongfully convicted, but also as a mentor, advisor, and inspiration to a multitude of other people's lawyers. His death is indeed a monumental loss to the criminal defense and civil rights bars. In the 1960s, Myron was one of the attorneys for George Whitmore, who dropped out of school in the eighth grade and was picked up by police in Brooklyn in connection with several rapes and three murders. Police interrogated Whitmore until he falsely confessed, even though he was in South Jersey at the time of some of the crimes, watching Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. The confession was 61 type pages in length. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in its 1966 Miranda decision, referred to the Whitmore confession as, quote, the most recent conspicuous example of police coercion. As a result of this coerced confession, New York State abandoned the death penalty in 1965. More recently, in 2013, Myron appeared in court on behalf of Everton Wagstaff, who, along with Reginald Connor, was convicted solely on the word of a crack-addicted police informant of kidnapping a teenage girl found dead in 1992 in East New York. Mr. Wagstaff spent two decades compiling records to prove that the informant's and detective's accounts were impossible. He wrote to Myron from prison seeking his help. Myron worked with attorneys from the Innocence Project, the law firm Davis, Polk & Wardwell, and the Legal Aid Society. In September 2014, the convictions both of Mr. Wagstaff and Mr. O'Connor were vacated. Myron was especially well known for securing the freedom of former boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter after he served 19 years in prison for three murders in New Jersey. He also represented Yusef Salam, one of the five young black and Latino men who falsely confessed on videotape to the 1989 beating and rape of a woman who became known as the Central Park Jogger. After serving terms of 7.5 to 13.5 years, the five were finally exonerated in 2002, when an imprisoned man confessed to the crime and prosecutors confirmed his account with DNA evidence. We at Law & Disorder interviewed Myron most recently in 2014. We remember him fondly as we take a listen to parts of that conversation. Myron, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, we're very familiar with the case, but for our listeners who are not aware, can you briefly describe Reuben Hurricane Carter's lawsuits and prison cases?
Well, there were no civil lawsuits. He was a defendant in a criminal case in New Jersey, involved the triple shooting and ultimately three murders of three people in the Lafayette Bar and Patterson, New Jersey, going back to 1966. And he and his co-defendant, John Artis, were represented at the first trial, and they lost. That is, they were convicted. And then Reuben started his campaign to get out of jail and wrote his book, The 16th Round. And ultimately, in 1974, when the eyewitnesses, supposed eyewitnesses, who were not, we claim, recanted. Selwyn Rabb, who was an investigative reporter at the Times, who had worked with me before that on the Whitmore case, Selwyn asked me whether I was interested in representing Reuben. And I had just finished 7 years working on this other case and really didn't want to get involved in another long battle, but I went to see Reuben, and he was charismatic and powerful and a great thinker. He was a very, very, very intellectually strong person as well as being spiritually strong. And so I was drawn into his ambit, and then we went off. The killings were shotgun and pistol shootings of these three people. The original witnesses were two, I would say, criminal types who were involved in breaking into a factory a block away at the time of the shootings in 1966. And then the first conviction was set aside because it turned out that the prosecution had been trading benefits to those two particular people for their stories, which their original information and all original information described people completely different than Reuben and John. John was a tall young man. Reuben was a very black, very solidly built, bald-headed person. And you wouldn't begin to suspect them from the information about the descriptions of the people who did the killings. One of the people who ultimately died, in fact, two of them saw Reuben and John in the hospital that night, and they did not identify them and so on. It was almost a typical case, high-profile case, where you get people who are vulnerable and easily manipulated because of their need for their own benefits to falsely testify. Then we set aside the conviction because of learning about the benefits that were given to the witnesses and went again to trial in 1975. At that time, the atmosphere had changed. There was a new prosecutor. They came up with the theory that this was actually a racial revenge killing. Earlier that night, a white former bar owner had shot and killed the black purchaser of the bar from him. And that was always known, and there was no motive attributed to the killings in the first trial. But in the second trial, really based upon nothing but speculation and bias, they argued persuasively to the jury that this was really a racial revenge killing, that the black people went into the white bar, the Lafayette bar, to revenge the killing of the black person by the white former bar owner. And that was one of the ultimate reasons why, many, many years later, the convictions were set aside. But the other reason was the one I was most prominently involved in. At the second trial, Mr. Bellow, who was the only supposed eyewitness who testified, there were two of them at the first trial, was being questioned by me on the stand as to why he recanted his recantation. The prosecution had persuaded him to again tell the story he told at the first trial, identifying Reuben and John. And I was trying to establish that they had falsely manipulated him when I was pulled into the chambers along with my co-counsel, Lewis Steele, who represented John Otis, and told that if I questioned him further, the jury would learn that he had passed the lie detector test supporting what he had said at the first trial, supporting his identification. And we did have that test, and it seemed like that was the result, because that's the way it was written. In fact, that was a fraud. It was, just like the first trial, it was a total cheat. The polygraph results were completely the opposite of what they were purported to be. Just before the sentencing in the second trial, 1976, I called the polygrapher, who we thought was an enemy, and he was in a sense, but I had an intro to him from a well-known New York City investigator. And I said, "Hey, John," said, "I could call you and speak to you and give you my name and that you can rely on me." And then all of a sudden he tells me that the results of the test were opposite to what they were purported to be. You think we could win? Well, we didn't win then. We didn't win for, how many years? That was 1976. It was 1985 when we finally got a federal judge to recognize these two basic flaws in the prosecution. That was Judge Sarakin, who went over all the years of all the evidence and came to that conclusion that we were essentially cheated. I use the word cheated because that's what it was. And the prosecutors in that case, two of them became judges, rewarded for what they did.
Well, let me ask you, so the two key elements were being cheated was, one was the false lie detector results, right. And the other one, say it again, was?
That John and Reuben killed the white people at the Lafayette Bar to retaliate from the earlier shooting of a black bartender that night by the white former bar owner. There's no evidence that John or Reuben were involved in being biased against white people, just the opposite. They both had lots of relationships with white people. There was just no evidentiary basis for this argument.
The racial revenge theory.
Racial revenge theory was made up based upon the fact that it had to be because a white person killed a black person, so black people killed white persons. I mean, it was the most flimsy, but in many ways very persuasive. Remember, this is a community that was shocked by the killings. There were three of their own who were killed, one who survived. Reuben was not a popular person. He had been an outspoken civil rights person. There were, false rumors about his being a person who would support killing people, killing white people. I mean, it was a cesspool of rumors without any evidentiary basis that led to the prosecution. And I can tell you, as one who was there, that the entire community almost in Passaic, New Jersey, treated us like we were the devil. We were enemies. I mean, it was the coldest community reception I ever encountered any place.
Myron Michael Smith here. I was part of his defense early on and went down and met him in prison in Trenton, and then again at that minimum security prison that he got into.
what confused me about why people would think there was a man who was on the top of his game. He was contender for the middleweight title. He had a wife. He had a daughter. It just didn't make any sense that he would go to a bar that he'd never been to before and kill people he never knew. It was just, you know, utter racist fantasy that they could do that to him.
Well, I of course agree with you. And when you speak of Rubin's public face and notoriety, I didn't know he was charged originally, but I read about the conviction in a newspaper and heard about it on TV when that happened. That was in 1967, I think. And I just thought this makes, I was a sports fan, and I thought this makes no sense. How could a person like that? Why would a person like that? How could he possibly do that? He was prominently known, his face was known, and so on and so on. So that's one of the reasons why, same reaction you have, that I got interested in working for Rubin in the first place.
The other thing that was so striking, and Rubin told me, the degree of corruption in the state of New Jersey. I suppose that you could say it hasn't changed much with Chris Christie. But back then, Rubin said that the prosecutor in nearby Patterson County, of course, Rubin was in Passaic County, but the prosecutor in Patterson County was a attorney named Byrne, who later became governor. Rubin said that it was Byrne that arranged to give the lighter sentence to Bellow and Bradley in exchange for their testimony. So Rubin said this thing is corrupt from top to bottom.
Well, I think it was corrupt, but I don't know about the Byrne angle. They certainly gave benefits to both Bellow and Bradley, who had been the original witnesses, by not prosecuting them or not putting them in jail for their various crimes. They were very unreliable witnesses. Bellow was an exceedingly dishonest person, and the whole story about the lie detector test is absurd because he was kind of the immoral kind of person who didn't care about the truth. That was established over the years in many investigations and many aspects of the case.
Let's talk about Rubin and the work that he did, because it seems to me, without being melodramatic, he was truly a tragic and heroic figure. And after, with your great legal skills, got him out of prison, he then moved up to Canada and did work supporting innocent people.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
I followed Rubin's career afterwards. We would talk occasionally, but Rubin would call every year on the anniversary of his release. He would call us, and I think he called the Judge Sarakin in California by that time. And so we knew what he was doing, and he got dedicated in two different organizations. One was the Association in Defense of Wrongful Convicted People in Canada. He got a group of Canadian do-gooders and free thinkers to join him in fighting to set aside convictions of people who were wrongfully convicted in Canada and elsewhere. And a number of cases were successful that were brought by that organization. And then he split with that organization and formed a new group called Innocence, something like that. I can't remember the name. And he continued to do that on his own right down to the end of his life. He was interested in supporting a convicted person in Kings County and had just been fighting to help get him out. He did what he thought he should do to return to the world his principled good efforts to set aside injustices. Rubin was an extraordinary person. He was, when I say he was intellectually very strong, remember that he wrote a couple of books, but it was not just that he wrote the books. He participated with us in the defense of his case with Leon Friedman of Hofstra, who joined us after the second convictions, and with Lou Steele. He would vet the briefs that we sent. We used to have a relay between Rahway Prison and my office sending him drafts, and we would get the comments back. He was a very unusual client.
He also took principled stands while in prison, refusing to wear a uniform or to work at prison jobs. Was he well regarded inside?
He was kind of a hero to a lot of the prisoners. Rubin, as you say, refused to act like a prisoner because he wasn't anyone who was guilty, he said. So he didn't eat prison food. He didn't take prison assignments. He didn't wear prison clothes. And somehow or other, he was able to pull that off. Some of the guards even supported him because they recognized his principal stand. Early on, when one of our appeals failed after, I think it was one of our appeals, I can't remember whether it was one of the earlier appeals, Reuben essentially had an emotional breakdown in prison, a mental breakdown, and he was hallucinating and just like out, you know, beyond the depths of despair. And there was a white, well-known because of his crime, prisoner who took Reuben aside. They were both leaders. One was the leader of the whites and one was the leader of the blacks in the prison, and nurtured Reuben through that time, and he came back even stronger. You can't imagine what a strong person he was. After the second conviction, when our lives were so bleak, I mean, we met in a prison, in a basement prison in New Jersey, and we were weak in spirit, and you know, where are we going to go now? And somehow pulled up our socks and went forward and reestablished our case. But after that second conviction, Reuben did an analysis of all the evidence at the second trial on big, big boards with little flip cards so that you look under what the prosecution claimed and what the evidence, the impeachment evidence was. I still have it. It's like a unique document. It's like 4 by 5 feet wide and has many, many boxes. And that's when I knew he was really coming back. As I said, he was a participant in his case as no other client I've ever had.
I think it's implicit in what you've said, but can you speak briefly about what kind of inspiration you derive from your clients?
Well, you know, we always want to believe that we are working for people, that we are serving people who are innocent. And I know that's not always true for lawyers, but I've had a series of clients who have been not just innocent, but who have been inspirational because of their insistence, despite the fact that they could get out of jail, for example, that they're not guilty and that they ultimately will prevail. I have one right now. I've been waiting for a decision in the Second Department in state court in New York, and I'm waiting for their integrity unit in Kings County to revise the case. This man has been in jail since 1992 and could have gotten out of jail 10 years ago and doing the same kind of stance that Carter had taken. He refuses to admit that he's a sexual offender. He could have been let out and on parole 10 years ago. His insistence on being an innocent person and will not compromise with the system is the kind of inspiration that, you know, pushes us on as lawyers. If the client can do it, then we should, too, put out to the utmost. I guess that's the best answer I can give you.
Thank you so much, Myron Baldock. It's an honor to talk to you.
It really is. I mean, it's extraordinary, your career and what you've done and, of course, what the system remains, unfortunately.
Well, I'm a long time ever supporter of WBAI, so I appreciate the compliments.
Thank you, Myron Baldock, for being on Law and Disorder.
Take care, everybody.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Tell somebody. In my life I've seen a lot of things go down. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right, trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Been down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind, but I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find.
You don't know what you would do until you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester.
Sienna Baskin is the managing director of the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center in New York City, where she's worked since 2007, and she joins us today. At the Sex Workers Project, she both directs a team of lawyers and advocates that provide legal services to sex workers, and she's also responsible for the Sex Workers Project's policy and law reform work. Sienna has returned from a Fulbright Fellowship in New Zealand, a country that completely decriminalized sex work and prostitution in 2003. She went there to learn what effects, both positive and negative, decriminalization has had, both for people engaged in sex work and for the society more generally. Welcome, Sienna, to Law and Disorder. All right, so Sienna Baskin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're at the Sex Workers Project. You've been there really since law school. Tell us a little bit about the project and about the work that you do there.
So the Sex Workers Project is part of the Urban Justice Center here in New York City. The Urban Justice Center has been around for about 30 years, serving marginalized New Yorkers in a variety of ways. And the Sex Workers Project has been in existence since 2001. And we provide legal and social services to anyone who's been involved in the sex industry for any reason, which we include people who voluntarily are involved in sex work, as well as people who've been coerced or forced into sex work. And in addition to providing these services, we also engage in policy work and policy advocacy on the local all the way to the international level. And we also do research on these issues, on sex work and human trafficking.
So New York State is one of the states that has created specialized courts to handle people who've been arrested for prostitution or sex work. And some people think this is a really positive innovation. We've got specialized courts for domestic violence, for certain kinds of drug crimes, and now for sex work. What's your view? How well do you think they're working?
Well, for one thing, I think we have to be a little critical and look deeper into these courts and realize that in some ways they're nothing new. They have had diversion programs and courts set up specifically for people who have been arrested for prostitution for decades in some parts of the city. New York State recently rolled out these courts in 11 different jurisdictions. So the breadth is a little bit new. And we really see it as sort of a mixed bag. We have seen some positive outcomes. We've seen some of our clients who have been arrested for prostitution and might otherwise do jail time or be held on bail for long periods of time or have resulted in criminal convictions, have better outcomes through these specialized courts because instead of a conviction, they may be offered to take what's called an ACD, an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal, which means sort of a waiting period and then the case is dismissed. So they result in less of a criminal record. But we also see some outcomes that we're not as excited about. One being that the model is really based on this philosophy that people who are involved in sex work there needs to be an intervention and they need therapy and they need rehabilitation or treatment. And I think, you know, this is coming from the diversion model that applies to people who've been arrested for drug convictions, that they need drug treatment. But sex work is not a disease or something that really requires treatment. It may, you know, people may have outstanding issues with maybe a drug dependency or a mental health issue, but many of our clients are not doing sex work because of those issues. They're doing sex work because they need income, and the courts aren't really designed to solve that problem. So we are concerned when social services, which are a necessary thing that we should have in our society, are offered in this way that you have to be arrested to be referred to them, and then you're referred to them, and if you don't comply with them, that arrest or that conviction is still hanging over your head. We find that to be coercive and not the best way to provide services to people who are engaged in sex work or to anyone.
Well, what kind of social services? I mean, they don't give these people jobs, do they? They don't find them an apartment, do they? I mean, what kind of social services are offered to these people in New York City?
Well, that's one thing we're trying to find out a little bit more about. There's a wide variety. There are a lot of different programs that have been engaged in the courts, and in fact, we are one of them. So if someone is arrested for prostitution in New York City and they advocate for being assigned to us, then they can come to our program and do a certain number of sessions and get the result that the court is offering. And what we provide is one-on-one case management and counseling, if that's helpful. So if someone wants to work on the job training program or wants to work on their resume, they can work with us on that. You know, it's kind of just based on what needs they have and what might be helpful to them, which we think is helpful for those who come through our program. But programs offer a wide variety of different kinds of programming for people that are coming through these court systems. It could be group counseling, it could be yoga, it could be therapy, it could be, you know, a really wide variety of things. So we're really interested in finding out exactly what is being offered and if there are any best practices and if there are any practices that are harmful.
It strikes me as a bit odd that the criminal justice system is the portal for the distribution of needed, in many cases, social services for people engaged in or accused of being engaged in sex work or prostitution. What do your clients think about the fact that they have got to go to a criminal court proceeding in order to get social services that they may feel they're otherwise entitled to?
Well, they don't necessarily have to go to this court proceeding to get the social services if the social services are available free of charge in other ways. But one thing we're concerned about with this trend, because the idea of specialized courts for people arrested for prostitution is definitely something that is being embraced more widely, and other states and other jurisdictions are looking to New York as a model. So we have to look at it not just exactly how is it playing out in New York, but what does it mean more broadly? And I think one thing we're concerned about is will social services be available outside of the court system if funding is diverted to these kinds of programs, if programs can't sustain themselves without participating in these court systems. So we're concerned about that trend because we think, for one thing, not everyone needs social services who's involved in the sex industry or wants them or is in a place to take advantage of them. And for those that do, the best outcomes are when people engage voluntarily, when they're ready, when they want to engage in services and they know what they need and they can establish that relationship voluntarily, not within a coercive criminal justice system.
But to follow up on Catherine's question, you've just come back from New Zealand where they don't have a criminal court porthole because sex work is not criminalized in New Zealand anymore. So how do they do it there?
Well, everything is incredibly different there. It couldn't be more different. And it was really exciting to be there for 3 months talking to sex workers, talking to government officials about how they work on these issues without the criminal justice system being such a big part of it. So sex work is decriminalized. You can do sex work on the street. You could do it in your home. You can do it in an organized, sort of more employment setting. It's legal to sell sex and buy sex and manage a sex work sort of business. And there is regulation, but the regulation is not intended to eliminate the sex industry. It's intended to, you know, ensure safety and prevent violence and things like that. So it's incredibly different. And there are services available to sex workers. Many of those services are provided by an organization called the New Zealand Prostitutes Collective, which is a sex worker-run organization that has offices in every major city. And they have counseling programs. They have free healthcare programs that they've had since the 80s. And they have, you know, distribution of safer sex supplies. And they just provide a lot of community for people who are engaged in the sex industry. And I think that's a really amazing model. I think it's really hard to have a model like that here in the United States when sex work is so stigmatized and people are so afraid to come forward.
So having lifted the criminalization of sex worker prostitution in New Zealand, do they treat it like all other kinds of work? Do regular labor laws apply, occupational health and safety? You know, into what legal bucket then does it fall once the criminal law is removed from the scene?
Well, I think your instinct is right. They do treat it like other forms of work in a lot of different ways. So there are regulations that apply to all workers, such as occupational health and safety. And once sex work is decriminalized in New Zealand, the agency that's responsible for the safety of workplaces came together and drafted an occupational health and safety guide for the sex work industry that is expected to be followed. And there are responsive inspections. So if there's an issue in, say, a brothel or a place where people are working, these government agencies can go and inspect and provide, you know, tips on how to make it a safer work environment. The regulations like that, systems of laws like that are ones that apply to the sex industry. And then there are, you know, there are some regulations that are specific to the sex industry. There's a brothel certification system that if you're running a brothel with more than a certain number of employees, you have to just get certified by the government to do that. And there's some regulations around advertising and things like that. But in general, it looks a lot more like regulating of other industries, like, you know, a bar or other ways that people work.
And do sex workers have any rights, special rights that they didn't have before?
Well, they didn't have many rights before, so it's not that they have special rights. They just have, you know, rights that other citizens are used to enjoying, such as the right to enforce a contract. So if someone purchases sex or contracts to, you know, say, oh, I'll give you this $100 for this sexual experience, and then reneges on that contract, they can enforce that contract in civil court. They can take their employer to court if they are, you know, having issues with their employer, contractual issues or harassment issues. There was a really incredible decision not too long ago from one of their higher courts of a woman who worked in a brothel who was being sexually harassed by the brothel owner. And she successfully argued that was sexual harassment. And there was testimony about, yes, even in a brothel, there are norms of behavior that you have to comply with, and it's not okay to make someone feel unsafe or that they have to, you know, respond to requests for sexual favors. Just because they work in a brothel doesn't mean they should be subjected to that kind of behavior by an employer. So the court found on behalf of the sex worker, and, you know, things like that would be hard to imagine happening in the United States.
I read an article by you, Sienna, on the abuse of sex workers by police officers in New York City, which is really horrific. And if you think about it, what's the person going to do? Because they're criminals and they really can't avail themselves of the police or the courts to get any redress. What about New Zealand? Is there police abuse of sex workers in New Zealand like there is in New York City?
Well, that was really one of the most striking and moving findings that I had when I was there in New Zealand, both from talking to sex workers and reading the research and talking to police officers, is that that's really, really different. Police are seen more as a source of safety, as someone that you can go to if you're assaulted or if something bad happens to you. If you're a sex worker, the police share information with sex workers about, you know, people they need to watch out for. It's just a completely different relationship, and it's hard to, another thing that's, you know, a little hard to imagine in this, in the United States, where the police in general are often to be feared, especially by marginalized and criminalized people, you know, in general, not just sex workers, and the police play a different role in New Zealand society in a more general way, but the difference in how police are seen as a resource and a source of safety for sex workers after this decriminalization law passed is really remarkable and is by itself, I think, a reason to look at this model and to see how we could implement it more broadly.
Any other findings you want to share with us about how sex work has changed under a situation of decriminalization, or anything that surprised you in your research in New Zealand?
Well, there are a lot of surprises. I think in some ways that sex work hasn't changed that much after decriminalization in terms of the work itself. And I think that, one thing that was feared by people who oppose decriminalization is that if they decriminalized the sex industry, it would really boom. It would grow. There would be way, way more of it. Way, way more people doing sex work, more people buying sex, that it would become a bigger part of the economy. And that really didn't happen. There was no real change in how large the industry was after decriminalization. And in fact, decriminalization removed some barriers for people who wanted to leave the sex industry but felt locked into it because it removed criminal records. So people who had criminal records of doing prostitution, they were erased, and therefore they didn't have to worry about that kind of stigma if they were going to apply for a job with a background check. So it did eliminate some of those barriers for people to leave the sex industry. And that was an interesting finding as well.
The parallel to the war on drugs, I think, is obvious. And I read an article about the police chief in Canton, Ohio, yesterday, who was talking about what they do in Canton, Ohio. He said, if somebody walks into a police precinct under my jurisdiction and turns over their drug paraphernalia and says, I want help, we don't arrest them, we help them. So this police officer has totally decriminalized drug addiction in Canton, Ohio. And I was just fantasizing about how it would be here in New York City if they just didn't enforce these laws, which are so these people are like triply oppressed to begin with. And then to have police demanding sexual favors and beating them up and taking their condoms, that would all disappear if sex work was decriminalized. So my question is, what is your organization doing towards that end, and what can people do to help?
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's really archaic that we got calls. We know that people were arrested for prostitution the night of the blizzard. when all the snow was coming down, it's just such an egregious misuse of resources. In addition to everything else, it seems like something that really does need to change. And it won't eliminate all the problems. There will still be violence. There may still be police violence against marginalized people who may be doing sex work. But it takes away that authority that the police now have that creates these coercive situations in these coercive environments, and we think that's a really good step in the right direction. So, I don't think we're going to decriminalize prostitution tomorrow in New York State or in any state, but there are ways we can work slowly towards that. And one way is to just talk about it and talk about it as a reasonable approach, whether it's in the context of look how we've changed the way we treat drug use or marijuana use, or bringing up these other harms that criminalization results in. And the other thing we can do is reduce the impact of criminalization. Those small incremental changes really do benefit our clients. We think of it as harm reduction in the criminal justice system. Currently, New York City has no way of expunging even a minor record. So people who have records of, being arrested for prostitution 30 years ago, it's still on their record. It's still a problem for them. These are things we can work on in the meantime while we build a case for making this not a crime anymore.
When you and I have spoken about the particular vulnerability of some populations in New York, you've noted the intersection of the criminalization of prostitution and how we treat undocumented people or people whose legal status here is somewhat vulnerable. Could you say a little bit more about what you're seeing with in massage parlors and other parts of the city where the police are doing raids these days?
Sure. One thing that people might not know about, another really antiquated law, in fact, it's the first immigration law, federal immigration law that ever came into being in the United States, is a law that makes sex workers inadmissible to the United States. So if you have a record of having done prostitution, even if you don't have a conviction for it, you are by law inadmissible to the United States. And what that means is people who are otherwise eligible for immigration status, say they could apply for asylum or a family-based visa, if they have a record of doing prostitution or criminal conviction for prostitution, they are then ineligible for that. So it treats prostitution as this incredibly serious crime that we need to keep people like that out of the United States. And it makes people who are, you know, immigrant sex workers even more vulnerable, even makes it even more difficult for them to gain other employment or have other other options. So, and unfortunately, you know, we do see a lot of targeting of immigrants, sometimes by the police. We've seen a real uptick in arrests of Asian women for prostitution in New York City. There are especially targeting of different establishments that are run by Asian women, some of which may have prostitution going on in them, some of which may not, massage places, body work places. And unfortunately, these are happening under the guise sometimes of, well, there may be people being exploited in these locations, so we need to raid them and find out what's going on. But unfortunately, they rarely actually lead to help for the people that are in those locations. Maybe they are being exploited, but they are not being screened for that. They are not being necessarily helped out of those situations by being arrested themselves. In fact, the arrests are very traumatic and can lead to all these other consequences that I mentioned around immigration status.
Excellent. So how can people who want to know more get in touch with the Sex Workers Project and learn more about the kind of work that you're doing?
Oh, yes. Forgot about that question. So we have a very extensive website, sexworkersproject.org, that has our contact information as well as all our research reports and our media appearances and more information about our services as well. We have a hotline that's 646-602-5617.
More slowly.
Sorry, 646-602-5617. Journalists can call that. People who are looking for services can call that. So that's a good way to reach us. And we also have a Twitter account and Facebook, and all that's on our website. So we encourage people to be in touch with us and be connected to us if you're interested in these issues.
Well, Sanna Baskin, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. You do terrific work. We hope that the Sex Workers Project thrives. And
thank
we thank you,
so you
again.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks so much, Sienna. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.